Fascinating. Now, Gene Wheaton, a longtime veteran of black operations.
That's correct.
It was also a major source of information for the Christic Institute's investigation, and an individual who I've never spoken directly to him, but we have numerous professional colleagues in common, an individual who appears to be very respectable.
Yes.
So Gene Wheaton, then, I take it, is one of your sources of information for
much
of this.
That's correct.
And so this then, because people will no doubt be wondering, well, gee, you know, where does he get it? You know, you cited many documentary sources, but much of your information for this piece of research has come from Gene Wheaton, correct?
Well, allow me to say this. Mm-hmm. Gene Wheaton, independent of mine, has done his own research with a diametrically a different viewpoint about Iran. He was a pro-Shah, and I was an anti-Shah.
Okay.
We both came up with the same conclusion, what was going on in Iran.
Right.
And this is the significant part of my investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the interviews that I have done with Gene Wheaton in regard to his time and his residence in Iran, it is phenomenal. And I get to that in one point if the time permits.
Right.
Now, the IBEX project was a CIA control for Rockwell unit. They were building equivalent of NASA there in Iran. This is in accordance to actually Gene Wheaton. AWACS would be added on the top of that system.
No, the AWACS, it should be said, are aircraft with very sophisticated electronic warning devices. Go ahead.
Right. The IBEX project was set up by Hakim and his mold in the Shah's government, the Shah's brother-in-law.
Okay.
Eric Van Marbot from Defense Security Assistance Agency, the Pentagon Arms Sales Division to Iran, was in charge of the IBEX project from the U.S. He came aboard the Hakim Secor team while working for DSAA, according to former Director General of SAVAK. During the Shah's regime, Albert Hakim was identified by SAVAK as someone connected with CIA. That is a quote.
A quote from who?
From the former director of SAVAK, who I believe presently resides in the United States.
Okay. Now, that isn't Mansour Rafizadeh, is it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, go ahead.
Hakim met with General Secor for the first time in Iran, as we all know that, in mid-1970s, through ex-CIA agent Edwin Wilson, that presently is serving a 53-year prison sentence in the United States for dealing with Omar Gaddafi of Libya.
Among others. Just in fact, the Wilson-Turpel operation dealt with just about every international organization or unit with which the United States is supposedly, or to which they're supposedly opposed, but which, much like the Islamic fundamentalist government of Iran, in fact appears to have been, at least for a period of time, a bedfellow of the U.S. Now, again, who is it that it was the associate of Wilson?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch
it. Now, the individual that was an associate of Edwin Wilson was?
Wilson had been introduced to Secor
right.
by Theodore Shackley,
right.
who was the deputy director of the CIA in charge of all the global dirty tricks, and he was put on that job by Mr. George Bush when he was actually the director of the CIA. Of course, Theodore Shackley had many other activities within the CIA, and he had also very close tie with William Sullivan, who became the Iranian-American ambassador in Iran when Carter took office.
And he was the fellow who was the U.S. ambassador when the abortive, the February 14th, 79...
That's correct.
...occupation of the U.S. embassy took place with Mr. Khashoggi.
Right.
Go ahead.
And his subordinate in Miami, Theodore Shackley and his subordinate in Miami, and Lars Thomas Klein,
right.
THOMAS,
mm-hmm.
and CLINES.
Now, by the way, you're now into the one step beyond Hall of Fame or Hall of Shame, perhaps. These are names extremely, they're names which are better known than George Washington on this broadcast.
That's correct.
Go ahead.
Now, Shackley, as we know, had occupied one of the agency's most sensitive positions. He was associate deputy director of the Director of Operations, second in command for all CIA global clandestine dirty tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to also remember that we talked about this and we touched on that Theodore Shackley also was, according to some record, Mr. George Bush's speechwriter when he became the candidate for the Republican Party's presidential election that then he submitted to Mr. Ronald Reagan.
That's an allegation I've never heard of. I'm very familiar with Shackley because he's one of the most significant names in post-World War II American intelligence, but I've never heard that allegation. Where did you hear that, Farhad?
This was in one of the books that I have researched, and I believe that is an unauthorized biography of George Bush.
Okay.
That's the name of the book.
But you don't know the author off the top of your head?
I don't have it off of the top of my head, but I can find that out.
Okay.
I don't have all my documents.
Of course. Well, then now we're right back to where we began the discussion this evening. Go ahead.
He was, as we know, that he was supposed to become the CIA director if Gerald Ford would have been reelected as a president. Now, what is significant here, in 1974, Hakim created the Stanford Technology Corporation with offices in Vienna, Virginia, and San Jose,
mm-hmm.
California.
Mm-hmm.
Stanford Technology was later to prove very profitable for both Hakim and Mr. General Secor in the hostage affair and Iran-Contra.
Mm-hmm.
We know that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this information, at least maybe your audience would hear that for the first time.
Right. By the way, I would note, for the benefit of the audience, dipping back into my own archives for the moment, that among the companies which was incorporated into Stanford Technology was a pre-existing company called International Imaging Systems, which had been part of an electronics company called TCI, headed up by a fellow named Otto von Bolschfing, a key SS operative during World War II, an individualist who was part of Hitler's so-called Final Solution to the Jewish problem, an associate of Alfred Eichmann's, Adolf Eichmann's, excuse me, and then von Bolschfing became a key operative of the Reinhard Gehlen spy organization, which worked on behalf of the CIA, then later came to the U.S. and set up a parallel organization to Gehlen's, again, a Third Reich alumni association, so to speak, and Alfred von Bolschfing, or Albert von Bolschfing, rather, who was the head of TCI, one of whose subsidiaries was International Imaging Systems, which then became part of Stanford Technology, something which I talk about in Radio Free America program number 30, about the Iran-Contra scandal. Go ahead, Farah.
Now, Gene Wheaton, I would consider him a U.S. intelligence insider, who actually lived and worked in Iran from 1971 to almost 1978.
Excuse me, the name was Otto von Bolschfing. Excuse me, I'm fusing a synapse. Go ahead, Farah. Sorry for interrupting, but I like to keep my facts straight. Again,
sure.
There are all sorts of nitpickers out there who will attack even the tiniest detail in order to, as you know, there are people who are just waiting to find fault with any of
sure,
this material.
Of course.
Go ahead, I'm sorry for interrupting.
He worked as a security advisor to various U.S. and Iranian government agencies during the Shah's regime. And in fact, he was recruited by Rockwell International at the request of the U.S. Embassy after three of the top Rockwell managers in Iran were assassinated in, I believe, was June of 1976. Now, this is a fascinating story, according to Mr. Gene Wheaton.
Okay.
Now, one thing that we have to remember here, in 1970s,
All right,
the Iranians made an extraordinary number of high-dollar purchases during, this is according to Gene Wheaton, it's an exact quote from him.
Okay, now, but tie this in with the assassination, Farah. Go ahead.
I will do that, because there is a part here we have to say that there was a diversion of funds used by taking off the sales of all this equipment that it was sold to Iran for the budget that was provided for all the covert operation that Theodore Shackley, Secor, and other people were involved. Now, in order to keep that quiet, they went to any extent to keep that quiet, according to Gene Wheaton. He says, the Iranians purchased a tremendous amount of high-dollar equipment during those days. And he goes, all based, now this is what is important. He says, all based on corruption. The 10 percenters were in the middle. The DSAA was controlled by the spook. This is according to Gene Wheaton. Every big order had to go through DSAA. The contract needed to be guided to a kickback were used for private profit and for covert operation.
So in other words, these arms sales were being run through DSAA, and some of the proceeds that were kicked back were then used to finance covert operations?
That's correct.
Okay.
According to Gene Wheaton.
According to Gene Wheaton, who is an individual who was directly and deeply involved in these things.
Right.
Go ahead.
In late 1975, Howard Fish ran the DSAA. Then Eric Van Marbot also was involved, also was Assistant Secretary of Defense to Schlesinger. Eric Van Marbot, these are all quotes by Gene Wheaton,
okay,
put into Pentagon by covert operators to set this sloppy system of accountability. He took over the DSAA when Fish retired. The plan was to have Secor get to top eventually, but the Wilson case ruined everything. Now, Wilson case, we're talking about the ISCO affair.
Mm-hmm.
Secor was protected by Frank Carlucci. Now, mm-hmm, I'm going to conclude by that statement by Frank Carlucci. Eric Van Marbot left, and then the Sears World Trade business was set up. Ed Wilson, Francis E. Turple, both former CIA agents.
Former belongs in quotes. Go ahead.
Right. And Shockley all became associated with the Stanford technology,
mm-hmm,
during Iran-Contra. Wilson is currently serving 52 years federal prison sentence for shipping arms to Libya in mid-1970s, and Francis E. Turple is still a fugitive. Now, to me, efforts were made to keep secret the diversion of funds generated by kickbacks for covert operation. They mm-hmm went to any extent. Anyone who attempted to expose the secret of these operations were eliminated. This is my interpretation of it. One instance was the murder of Rockwell International employees on August 26, 1979 at 7:30 a.m. The U.S. investigator on this case, Gene Wheaton, was a complete insider on this issue. And mm-hmm, I quote, this is exactly what he says. Quote, three Rockwell employees were machine gunned to death by unknown killers. One of them, Cartel, C-A-R-T-E-L, had gone home to blow the whistle on IBEX diversion.
Okay, now where were they assassinated?
In Iran.
In Iran, okay.
That's correct.
And this was 4 days. Is there any connection, Farah, between this incident on August 26th of 1979 and the publication of the article about the Carter administration's collusion with Iranian nuclear purchases?
I have no knowledge of that.
Okay.
But what is important is to find out how did this happen.
Right, because I noticed they were very close in time.
Yes.
Go ahead. We're 8/26/79, three Rockwell employees machine gunned in Iran, apparently in connection with the transfer of the IBEX CIA surveillance technology.
Right.
Go ahead.
This was, according to Gene Wheaton, this was pre-planned, and someone on inside had tipped off the killers that Carter was arriving back in the country. He didn't even go home, but instead, the three were headed for their office. According to Gene Wheaton, by the way, they were supposedly going to meet with Gene Wheaton at 10 o'clock that day.
And blow the whistle on the collusion.
Right.
Okay.
Frank Turple, Ed Wilson's assistant, was in Tehran that day.
Okay.
Who was still a fugitive. He flew into Tripoli 2 days after. This is all quoted by Gene Wheaton. Turple told the man that met him, "We have taken away Rockwell fellow. A man I know told me this." Close quote. This is all quote by Gene Wheaton.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this would bring us is to something very interesting. As you know that, I don't know whether we have touched on this or not, the role that Frank Carlucci played during the Carter administration. He was a deputy director of the CIA under Carter, and then he became Deputy Secretary of Defense exactly the first week of Mr. Reagan's administration. Now, there was an article published in July 23rd, 1992, on Thursday, on the LA Times, by Robin Echo Robin Wright. She has written an article in regard to titled Panel world demands new vision for a new world order. Now, there was an article published in July 23, 1992, on Thursday, on the LA Times, by Robin Robin Wright, Echo Robin Wrong. She has written an article in regard to titled Panel Demands New Vision for a New World Order. The treatment now, this is a quote, it says, the treatment of foreign policy issue is, quote, somewhere between distressing and appalling. Commission Chairman Winston Lord, former U.S. Ambassador to China and former head of the State Department's policy planning staff, added at the press conference Wednesday, we see no coherent vision here or abroad. Lord said that the United States has only its third chance this century to reshape the world affairs. This is our chance, the report says, to ensure that recent enemies become future enemies, that the present allies do not become new antagonists. Now, what is important is that there is a commission here, which I believe that is a Carnegie Endowment Commission, a Carnegie Endowment National Commission on Americas and the New World Ways, in his report has said that. Now, commission members also included former Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci, Admiral William J. Crowell, Jr., former Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, former Washington Governor Daniel J. Evans, United Negro College Fund President and former Democratic Representative William H. Gray, the third of Pennsylvania and former National League of Cities President and San Antonio Mayor Henry G. Cisneros,
yes.
Right, and the World Bank President Barbara Knobel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what all these things means today, what it really means that what we are witnessing around the world and what we have also witnessed, the movement of the Islamic fundamentalists throughout the world, and every hot spot that we observe, whether it's in the Middle East or the former Soviet republics or in Algeria, in Egypt, and even in Iran, is all as a result of the fundamentalist movement at one point of time were very instrumental to create this new world order.
Mm-hmm.
And now that the situation somewhat in absence of the Soviet domination and Soviet empire, or quote-unquote evil empire, I've created a new situation in Iran. I have predicted long time ago that we are going to see many movements and many incidents such as the things that is happening and we are observing throughout the world. And the latest one, we see the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York.
Right.
That is being linked to the fundamentalist in the Middle East. And we have to ask, what was the purpose of that and who benefited from all this?
Mm-hmm.
That is the issue.
Yep. I agree completely. I would note, too, some interesting details that have emerged. First of all, when the bomb first went off, it was described for several days, and people can go back to February 26th. Actually, the first day in the press would have been February 27th. The explosive was described as plastic explosive, which is very difficult to get a hold of. If you have plastic explosive, ultimately you must have gotten that from a military or intelligence outfit, because it's just not easy to get a hold of. Then, over the period of time, the explosive itself metamorphosed, rightly or wrongly, and obviously I wasn't there, so I can't absolutely what it was, and I'm not an explosives expert anyway, but at first it was described as a plastic explosive. That was true for several days. Then it became either dynamite, now homemade explosives. A Croatian group and the Ustashi, the World War II fascist collaborators of the Third Reich, like so many Third Reich elements then, or fascist elements, reconvened after World War II, and many of them were connected with the more extreme elements of U.S. intelligence. Croatian extremists were described as having phoned in about the blast 15 minutes before it occurred. Some 50-odd groups were described as having called up to take credit either shortly afterward or within a relatively short period of time. That then changed. They put the kibosh on that. I would note that this fellow, Mohammed Salameh, I call him Lee Harvey Salameh, then turns up with nitrate on his fingers, and he wants to get this van, and I don't know what role he may or may not have played. He might actually have been involved in some way as a low-level operative. Perhaps he's just a patsy, as I suspect. Maybe he's under mind control, too, which is another possibility. But now we're being told that this blast apparently was linked to Islamic fundamentalists. I noted, Farah, that of the papers that I've read, only the New York Times has stated that New York City law enforcement officials are absolutely livid over U.S. government, over federal authorities' leaks concerning the investigation, which, according to New York law enforcement officials, permitted a leak that which went to Newsday, which forced the premature arrest of Salameh and, in all probability, the escape, at least for the time being, of associates. I mention that because it suggests at least the possibility of collusion on behalf of the investigators with the perpetrators. I also note that this Islamic fundamentalist minister or preacher, this cleric who has been linked with Mohammed Salameh and with this fellow Nasser, convicted in connection with the assassination of Meir Kahane, that he was investigated in connection with, although acquitted, in connection with the assassination of Anwar Sadat, because the Sadat assassination, the trail of that points in the direction of the United States. I hope to get to that. Some of those connections next week. Anwar Sadat was assassinated by Islamic fundamentalists. It's worth noting that two days before he was killed, Hosni Mubarak, his successor, was meeting with George Bush. On the other side of Anwar Sadat was a fellow named Ghazala, who became the Egyptian Minister of Defense and was involved in the Itzko affair with some of the very people we've been talking about. Mubarak escaped unscathed. Ghazala escaped unscathed. Anwar Sadat got 28 rounds. And William Buckley, a CIA operative and for a time one of the top people, in fact, I believe he was chief of mission in Beirut, he was involved with putting together Anwar Sadat's security. And the behavior of Anwar Sadat's guards at the time of the assassination was very curious. They, rather than attempting to interdict Sadat's assassins, they turned their guns on the press. They didn't fire, but they turned their guns on the press photographers and said no pictures, which is a very strange way for a security detail to react when the person they're supposed to protect is being assassinated. William Buckley then, of course, was kidnapped by some of the kidnappers in the Middle East linked to Iran and to Islamic extremism, Iranian-based Islamic fundamentalism. And then the attempts to free William Buckley from his captors provided the rationale for the creation of the U.S. national security infrastructures designed to combat terrorism, which Oliver North utilized in the Iran-Contra scandal. Locating all of this, at least in terms of evidentiary tributaries, not necessarily hard connections, but evidentiary tributaries with the elements that we've been talking about and with what I've been talking about in Radio Free America 38. What, in your opinion, Farah, does the future hold in terms of the future of the Islamic fundamentalist movement and how it relates to the U.S. national security establishment?
Well, to begin with, I have to say that the Islamic fundamentalist movement on a global level, in absence of the Soviet Empire, right now is being looked at by many of the third world countries as a tool and a vehicle that they can unite behind that. A good example of that was recently, I think that it was sometimes late last year, that, for instance, the KPFK had almost about a 3 days program on all the Islamic countries being represented on a program what happened was that all the Islamic countries that participated in that program, all of a sudden, their slogan, which it was being aired, was not the different countries that they were a part of the Islamic countries within the Middle East. However, their slogan was that Islam is the new savior of the world. Now, the program became actually 3 days. I have never remember during all the years that I have listened, for instance, to KPFK, and all of a sudden, 3 days program to be actually dedicated to one specific religion.
By the way, I would mention that KPFK is the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. Go ahead.
Right. And all of a sudden, the things turn around. What is important is to see what is the substance of all these Islamic fundamentalist movement. What do they want to accomplish? What is their objective? What they did? We should not forget that through the secret alliance that behind the door was made between the George Bush's loyalist and the Khomeini's fundamentalist, created the first Islamic Republic in the nature that it had in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequent to that, we find that the new world order emerged.
Go ahead.
What is important is that right now, in most of the hot spots around the world, including but not limited to Somalia, we see that these fundamentalists for years have been supported by the members of the national security establishment within the United States for a specific use within these countries.
Mm-hmm. Which was?
Well, Iran, you know, for instance, in Egypt, we see it, right, for instance, in Somalia. Where do you think that the Somalian fundamentalists were getting the weapon from?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, from the United States.
And who were they fighting? They were fighting the, for instance, quote-unquote, the members of the left or the supporters of the Soviet policies within this country. So this was a fight between the national security establishment using the fundamentalist in different part of the world
as an anti-communist.
Communism.
Right, go ahead.
Okay, now in absence of communism, these people have become a powerful force.
Okay.
Now, in Iran, we see that, for instance, there is a rival group, which is supposedly the moderate and the traditionalist. They both are fundamentalists. The only difference that they have is just how to preserve certain relationship or certain parts within the country that they would like to keep a control and nothing is going to change. But the fact is that I see that all the excuses that is being made, for instance, in February 13, 1993, just recently, there was shortly after the demonstration by the Iranian in Los Angeles against the regime in Iran, LA Times published an article by Robin Wright, and she, in that article, stated that Iran to Clinton is going to be the same as what
Iraq?
Iraq was George Bush.
In other words, basically, if I'm interpreting her prognostication correctly, that would be the goal for Clinton's military adventure abroad, much as Iraq was for Bush.
That's correct.
And, of course, we also support Saddam Hussein.
What I'm predicting is this, that what is happening since the election of Clinton to the office, during George Bush's last day, many members of the Islamic fundamentals, including Yazdi, were permitted and they were traveling all over the United States. And he came to Southern California. And one of the problems that I've been facing is since his visit to Los Angeles.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I confronted, in fact, with my questioning as I talked last time with the conversation that I had on January 12th with Gary Sick, I brought many of these issues that was happening, and he said to me that, well, in many of his writings, he has written a lot of things about that, which I told him that, yes, I found it very interesting that you have written, but I found it more interesting that there are many things that it was of significance. It was never discussed in any of your writings about what was happening in Iran. For instance, the Qarani issue, the intelligence briefing issue, the nuclear weapon program issue, all these things was never, ever touched by him. And what it is important, and I told him, that I find it more interesting is that these matters were not being discussed by a man of your stature who professes to be giving us a historical perspective on what was really behind October surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, I told him that I beg to differ with you. And he said, and I quote him, he says, okay, I mean, you are certainly entitled to the point of view, and I don't. There are many things in the course of my research I have not mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this, after all, was a major historical event, and you obviously place a tremendous amount of emphasis on these particular events, and I do not. But that is a difference of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Close quote. That was not a difference of an opinion. The fact of the matter is that these issues that I am raising and I investigated and I came up with played an important role in shaping the Islamic Republic of Iran,
mm-hmm.
which Mr. Gary Sikh failed to mention. These were the antecedent historical events that took place before the October surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do not discuss these things, you would not be able to put the October surprise in a proper perspective. And that is why that they put emphasis on the issues that it was very easy to disprove. But if you go and look at the situation in Iran from mid-70s, when today they're talking about the nuclear weapon program in Iran, but they fail to mention all the evidence from 1974.
Mm-hmm.
When they talk about the events that was taking place in Iran, they're talking about Shah's demise in 1976. They're talking about his successor in 1976, 2 days after Carter was elected to the office. These are the issues that have been ignored. And if you don't touch on those issues, you do not understand why the Islamic fundamentalist movement now emerging in the world on control, and they do anything that they want at will. Why, for instance, the Islamic fundamentalists in Iran have got a control over the Iranians, and they put them in the state of terror, that they would come and they would pick up on individuals like me that is trying to expose them so they can discredit me.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would point out, Farah, is that when our national security establishment decides to move in any given major direction, they do so when to make that move will satisfy a number of different strategic considerations at different levels simultaneously. And these people are not stupid and they're not incapable. As you've noted in one of our previous interviews, they have access to the finest supercomputers around, the finest people to operate those, and they're very, very intelligent and very dedicated to what they do. Fundamentalist religion in general has been promoted by elements of our national security establishment, both because it is anti-communist. Fundamentalist Christians are also anti-communist. And now, in the post-war period, post-Cold War period, I should say, Islamic fundamentalism may loom as an enemy which, if not as potent as the Soviet Union, could at least serve as a rationalization for continued enormous defense expenditures in this country, as well as for a more aggressive military posture abroad than we might otherwise have. As well, at least the threat of terrorism can also serve as a pretext for cracking down on civil liberties in the United States. Broader police powers, broader surveillance powers, etc. At some point, maybe we could, in a future broadcast, we can get into, I think, some of the even broader and more long-term considerations of religious fundamentalism, because as we destroy the planet physically, and from a physical standpoint, the planet Earth is in dire straits right now. The erosion of the ozone layer, and the destruction of the rainforests, either of those, the greenhouse effect, also could literally destroy all life on Earth, or at least all human life. And with a disintegrating world economy that I think is going to begin disintegrating at a much more rapid pace, one of the things that religious dedication can do, that fundamentalist religion can do, is to help blunt the impact of these things. My academic background is in psychology, and psychologists refer to one of the governing dynamics of human life. They refer to it as the reality principle. In other words, basically, you have to deal with your environment. You have to grasp what your environment requires of you in terms of rate, whether it's working or growing food or avoiding the cold or disease or whatever, and you must deal with those things. And in a world in which, from an environmental and economic standpoint, and I think ultimately politically, because of those two, reality is going to become increasingly unpalatable to most of the human race. It is going to leave human beings with basically a decision of whether to act to change their environment in such a way as to make it more habitable, more hospitable, or else somehow to adjust to the increasingly less hospitable environment. And a fundamentalist religion, just like drug use or alcohol use, can blunt an individual's sense of reality and their adjustment to that reality. If, just for example, you are a multinational corporation and you are engaged in seriously polluting the earth and abusing your workforce, not that all of them do that, but many of them do, and you wish the workforce to continue to be pliant in spite of the harsh conditions, and if you wish the people who are suffering because of the environmental destruction to continue to suffer, among the ways you can induce them to do that is to get them to believe in some sort of otherworldly solution to these problems, whether it's salvation through Allah or through Jesus or through a Jewish Messiah or through a New Age Messiah, because New Age, there are very strong connections between some elements of the so-called New Age in this country and the national security establishment. That is among the geopolitical goals, I believe, of our national security establishment's active support for not only Islamic fundamentalism, but for fundamentalist religion in general. I just wanted to put that bug out there, because I suspect that also has much to do with what has been going on over the past quarter century. The connections, for example, in the U.S. between right-wing Christians and our national security establishment are very well documented. Many listeners, and perhaps yourself also, far are familiar with the work of Sarah Diamond, who's done some good work in putting together the nomenclature of the Christian right and some of their connections. It's not a new phenomenon, but that's something else I would call to your attention and to the attention of the audiences. Farah, we've got about 50 minutes to the top of the broadcast. I don't have time to do the other material that I was going to present this evening. This is not said in regret, because I wanted you to be able to not only relate the frightening circumstances that you have been in, but also to share with us the groundbreaking research concerning the U.S.-Iranian nuclear collaboration, its implications for U.S. posture both at home and abroad today, and to, most fascinatingly to me, to connect that up with the very same Triple Wilson milieu that I have been focusing on for more than a decade. I was wondering at this point, Farah, is that what would you like to say by way of conclusion? Because I would like to put a wrap on things.
Few things that I would like to say.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, many of these documents and some of the discussions that I have had on your program, this is for the benefit of many of your listeners.
All of us, I would say.
You know, that we feel that while why such an important issues and information have not been heard,
mm-hmm.
It is not that I did not try. It is not because I have got a copy of every correspondence that I've had with major news media, with all the documents that I sent to every single one of them, including to LA Times reporters, on their own articles that I challenged them. Why didn't they investigate the article that was published on August 22nd, 1979, Los Angeles Times, by Robert Gillette, which it was titled, quote, Iran's purchase of laser process from LA company widen nuclear capability.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the article exposed the deal of this laser, and you know there was another article that it was published in March of 1980 that indicated actually Iran's nuclear bomb capability. what it shows to us that we are living in the environment, in the system, that they do not allow the truth to come out. We have been lied to, we have been deceived, and people that they go and they put their life on the line, on the front line to investigate, they do not have the equal chances to present their case and present their research and present their documents to the public.
That's why I'm giving you this forum this evening.
That's right. That. There are very, very few forums that we have. One is yours.
Mm-hmm.
One is, for instance, Roy Tuchman and partially KPFK, and say that Cebu in Portland, Oregon by Marlene Smith and Lenny Zinkin.
Mm-hmm.
And if the people and the listeners of your program, if they do not support us, we have done the work and we have put our life on the line, and they are trying at all times to discredit us. We cannot do it alone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We have to get their support. I have done everything that I could to the point that right now, as I'm talking to you, my mother has been in this country for a month and a half. I have had no opportunity to meet with this woman that I love very much. Why? Because I have felt that I do not want to create any danger for that woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you live in that sort of, I'm not a man of paranoia. Problems.
Well, there's a difference between paranoia, which is neurotic fear, and real fear, which is the sort of fear you've been experiencing. Go ahead.
You know, and we are losing everything that we have. The price of for democracy, it is not cheap. There are many people that have given their lives. I was asked by one of my relatives tonight, why do I have to do this? Because the price for the people that are coming after me, after you, for their rights, for their civil liberties, for their democracy, is a price that somebody has to pay. And the forum that is given the opportunity to people like me, to people like you, are very limited. And if they don't get the support to stay on, we can be shut up very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that you have to support you, not to only be the listeners. To listening, nothing would change.
Mm-hmm.
To act upon it.
Absolutely.
It does. And I am not asking people to come to save me. But when I am being crucified over there, and people like us, that they are trying to discredit us, to make us some bunch of kooks, some bunch of, you know, violent individuals, is not us that they are trying to discredit. Is the message that we want to get across, they would like to discredit.
Incidentally, speaking of that, there's an interesting detail, Farah. I don't know if you would feel comfortable discussing this, but after our first couple of conversations off the air, or actually I guess it was after maybe one of our first interviews on the air, you asked me what I thought of David McMichael, who was a former CIA analyst who has ostensibly at least turned against his former employers. And you had been in contact with McMichael, and you might want to tell us what he had to say about your research off out of print, because you asked me what I thought of him and what would happen.